Our next section of heat illness prevention is going to focus on identifying tools that can help you identify high heat risks and give you specific ideas about planning for prevention. So far, we've discussed how our body attempts to maintain healthy body temperatures, what acute illnesses we need to protect people from in times of high heat. In this section, we're going to talk about how we can get and interpret information on heat, both temperature and humidity, to develop prevention strategies to protect our workers so they don't become ill during hot work. First thing we need to understand is how do we assess how hot is too hot? And there are four things that come into play. First, we need to know things about temperature and humidity, so we're going to spend a lot of time on that. We've talked about work level. The higher work amount that you're doing means that you're going to be probably sweating a lot more, need fluid replenishment, and may need some more rest periods. A fourth factor is clothing requirements. So if you're wearing tight-fitting clothing or clothing that doesn't breathe, then you may be adding to the heat burden, and we talked about that previously. The first two, temperature and humidity, are related to how fast we heat up and how effective sweating will be to cool us down. There are a few systems out there that report a sort of a heat index that we'll use to help us decide how we need to manage heat exposure on a given day. We're going to spend time talking about two of them. The first one we're going to talk about is one that we use in occupational health. It's called the wet bulb globe temperature. And we'll talk about how it was developed, give you some tools online to look things up. But truth be told, most of the information that we have access to is going to be in terms of a heat index. So we'll talk about that as well. First, let's dive into this wet bulb globe temperature. Occupational health practitioners call it a WBGT for short. It takes temperature readings outdoors with three thermometers. It has first a thermometer that is regular, and we just call that temperature the dry bulb temperature. A second thermometer has a wetted sock that fits over the bulb of that thermometer, and the readings that we get from that one is called a wet bulb temperature. There's a third thermometer that has the sensor positioned with inside this thing called a black globe. The black globe is, think of the toilet tank float that you have in a flush toilet here in the US. That black ball is what we put a thermometer in, and that thermometer reads the globe temperature. That measures the radiant heat load because the radiant heat will heat up that black thermometer or the black globe and will get us a globe temperature. These three readings are used together to calculate a WBGT, and we've got those equations in your notes. WBGTs incorporate temperature and humidity of the workplace and how much metabolism is associated with the workload being undertaken by workers in that environment. And the table that we'll show you actually has two tables. So there's one for acclimatized workers, so somebody that's been out working in hot environments for about 2 weeks. And then we have the unacclimatized worker also on that table. And you'll see that there's more rest recommended for the unacclimatized worker. As somebody is new into the work environment, you would use the unacclimatized. And then after a two-week period, you'll be able to have people work a little bit longer because they're more acclimatized to the heat. We'll have a table that has that in your notes for this audio file. But as I said, truth be told, you can purchase a WBGT device, but most often weather services, the news, social media are going to be using this thing called a heat stress index. So I do want to spend a little bit of time on what that means and how to use that information to consider risk of outdoor work hazards for having acute heat illnesses in times of hot weather. The local news may share this heat stress index on the weather report. There are also smartphone apps that give real-time feedback on what is the heat index at a specific location. The apps typically use a weather report from the nearest weather station, and that tends to be the closest airport, big or small, relative to where the smartphone is positioned. You can get fairly local information on heat stress index. The heat stress index table typically includes information on relative humidity, ranges from 0 to 100%. Those tend to be on the rows. And then temperature, typically from 80 to 110 degrees Fahrenheit, is across the columns, across the top. And within each one of those cells in that table, you get a heat stress index that takes into account both the humidity and temperature. The table that I'll provide for you is in degrees Fahrenheit. And so the heat stress index is in that same reference of Fahrenheit degree. So you get this kind of real feel type of temperature that combines humidity impact and actual air temperature together. From this information, you'll see most of these tables have a color-coded index that give you four levels of risk. Initially, as heat starts to develop, you'll get this caution. The caution may say that workers may feel fatigued with prolonged physical activity in these conditions. So the heat index is typically in the range of 80 degrees Fahrenheit in these caution colors. As the heat index increases up to 88 to 102, you'll see a coding called extreme caution. In the extreme caution, we start to see risk of potential sunstroke, heat stroke, heat cramps, and heat exhaustion may be possible with prolonged exposure in that extreme caution band. When the heat index rises to the level of danger, which is a heat index of 104 to 127 Fahrenheit, we see these same outcomes, but now it's not just possible, but it's likely. As the heat index gets 128 degrees or higher, we're in extreme danger zone, and we have a very high likely possibility of having heat stroke outcomes. Caution, extreme caution, danger, and extreme danger are those four zones that are typically on those index tables. There are many resources available on the web or on smartphones. I will give you a link to the National Weather Service, but if you put in National Weather Service and heat index, you'll get to a page that will show you some information. You can also type into Google or your search engine heat index calculator, and you can enter in humidity and temperature and get a heat index and get some information on that. There are some smartphone apps. OSHA has a heat safety tool that is a downloadable app, both Android and Apple. That's a good one that people have used. There are some other ones that are out there as well. Your discussion question, I'll have you poke around and see which ones you like. But when using those apps, you're going to get information on the heat index in your area at the time you're running it. And you'll also get recommendations that come out of those heat indices that are calculated. It will give you recommendations about working outdoors in those current heat indices. When hot weather season arrives, you may also get some information from your weather service about heat warnings. And so it's important to understand the terminology that the weather reporters are telling you what is meant by these heat warnings. When you hear a weatherman say there's an excessive heat outlook, it says that within 3 to 7 days, there may be a heat event. They're kind of forecasting out in the future. They don't know exactly how bad it's going to be, but it's giving you a chance to maybe look at your scheduling for outdoor work, get drinking supplies ready, and you've got about 3 to 7 days to figure out how you're going to work outside if the heat advisory comes into play. That's an excessive heat outlook. It's projecting up to a week down the road. The next level is a heat advisory, and that's usually given about 12 hours before we enter into an extremely dangerous condition. Here, I'm recording in Iowa, so I did look up, and the criteria for calling a heat advisory is if the temperature is going to be, the daytime high is going to be more than 100 degrees Fahrenheit for two or more days, and the nighttime temperature is not going to fall below 75 degrees Fahrenheit, then we're going to have a heat advisory. And so there are precautions given to minimize the development of heat-related illnesses. That's a heat advisory. The next level is an excessive heat watch. It also is a few days out, and they will give an excessive heat watch that says we may have an excessive heat warning coming within the next day or three. That will turn into an excessive heat warning, and that's usually given 12 hours before the onset of this extremely dangerous heat condition. Again, here in Iowa, that would be given if we are anticipating two or more days of the high temperature meeting or exceeding 110 degrees Fahrenheit, again, with the nighttime temperature not falling below that 75 degrees Fahrenheit. We'll give you the link on the weather.gov page to get that information as well. During these heat advisory conditions, if we have an excessive heat warning or a heat advisory, we're going to have pretty high temperatures. And if we go and look at what the heat index is going to be, we can look and see what the risk of our workers being overcome with some heat illness, then we really should do some planning and get materials ready to protect our outdoor workers from heat illness. We also want to have communications with workers that may have medical conditions that put people at risk. So we've talked about that in the last chapter. The tools that we discussed earlier when we're coming into these excessive heat warnings or heat advisories is we want to make sure that we have water and, in many cases, electrolyte solutions, Gatorade, fruit juices, what is relevant for the health conditions of our workers. We want to have these drinking supplies available so that we can maintain hydration systems or fluid replenishment locations. And we also want to make sure that we have supplies at the ready in case we have to cool down workers that are experiencing heat exhaustion that's moving into heat stroke. It's critical to have these resources pre-planned. So these excessive heat watches and the heat outlook tells us it's time to pull together our supplies if we are making people work outside during these events. Another thing to think through is when these extreme heat events are coming, we can also look at changing the work schedule of folks that have to be outside. Do we have to have them outside during the heat of the day? Can we move work to the cooler morning hours or later in the evening? I know we may have to follow the sun, but maybe we have shorter days that start a little bit earlier in the day so that people don't have to be out when we have these really high temperature portions of the day. So before I close out this discussion, I do want to focus a little bit on hydration. We say hydrate, hydrate, hydrate is key because remember, we're sweating to evaporate and cool ourselves, so we are losing fluids. It's important to understand that we do need to hydrate in normal outdoor environments as well as in these critically high heat events. Since most people have an idea about sweating relative to exercise, let's use this as an example. When we're exercising in temperate conditions, so in a moderately regular indoor air temperature, say 70, 72 degrees, typically, if you're doing moderate exercise, you're going to lose about 1 liter of sweat per hour. When heat and humidity increase, that rate of sweat lost can be as high as 3 liters per hour. So that's a substantial amount of fluids, and it's important to replace these fluids throughout the day to keep up with hydration. So when we're working, we're doing it for much longer than an hour. If we keep losing 1 liter of sweat per hour, or in hot environments, 3 liters of sweat per hour, we do run the risk of dehydration. It is good to recommend for outdoor workers with moderate to heavy work this fluid replacement protocol. What we need to do is make sure that fluid is replaced throughout the workday. It's important to realize that when somebody starts to feel thirsty, that response experience is kind of in lag of when we should have been drinking. I like to coach people that if you're feeling thirsty, it's too late. So I do coach people to drink before you're thirsty as a motto for how to handle high heat conditions. I recommend folks at the bare minimum to plan on drinking a cup of fluid every 20 minutes, 3 cups an hour, and then as the heat levels increase, have more fluid replenishment every 20 minutes. In order to do that, we have to have fluids available. We have to have them nearby work. We don't want to have somebody have to put themselves in moderate activity to get to the water. So we want to have it nearby, and we want to make sure that we are encouraging workers to drink often. This kind of gives us some temperature milestones to think about. It gives us some fluid replenishment scenarios to think about with relationship to these different levels of heat in the environment. Next time, we're going to talk about the impact of dehydration on kidneys. It's an important long-term heat-related illness that is separate from the acute impacts of heat exhaustion and heat stroke that we've talked about earlier. So we'll bring in an expert on kidneys to help us walk through that portion of dehydration and kidneys. Again, as we wrap up this short lesson, I will leave you with the discussion question. It is in materials that accompany this, but I challenge you to use your phone, go to look at your smartphone apps that are available for you to download and try a few. Try the OSHA one, try one that has some good star ratings, and then poke around. See if you can enter in your location that has your city that you may be working in or going to go visit, and then look to see what the community service areas are and look at the recommendations and guidance that the app gives you for heat protection as you poke around. And we will meet back next time to talk about dehydration and kidneys.